Welcome to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast featuring tech legend Jay Gunkelman. He is the man who has read well over a half a million brain scans. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience's NeuroGuide Workshop March 4th and 5th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now.
Well, Jay Gunkelman, let's talk about some mental health in the news. Winona Judge, she came out with something. Did you catch that?
Yeah, and you know, she basically kind of said that there's a bunch of buttholes out there sending her messages of concern and whatnot about her performing and all of that. And Winona had a fairly aggressive response to the people expressing concerns. And she said, you know, she's okay. I'm okay. And there are people suggesting her manager was pushing her too hard to perform and whatnot. And she said, I'm okay. I'm angry. And additionally, she said, you know, my mother went through severe depressive phases before and recovered, and there was no way you could have told. So that actually suggests she's fairly far into the hierarchy of responses to the loss. There, you know, if you look up in the literature, you find, oh, there's five stages of recovery. No, other people, oh, there's seven stages of recovery. You know, the number doesn't so much matter as the progress. The first. She's obviously passed the first or second, or first and second, one or the other. Shock and denial are the first two, or one. They kind of can be combined to knock it from seven to six, you know.
Right.
And the next one is anger. And she's obviously anger. You're angry at the world, you're angry at the person in this case who did suicide, and anger is absolutely common. And then the bargaining, and that's the you know, the what ifs. What if I noticed that her depression was worse? Then maybe I could have done something, and maybe, you know, if I make a bargain with the gods or the devils or whoever you bargain with. Maybe you could, in some magical, bizarre way, reverse time and bring somebody back. You know, the bargaining and what if is just magical thinking, but it's also it's very common. What if this? How? And you're in part assigning blame to yourself or others. What if so and so had done such and such? What if I had done this? What if they had done that? You know, and the bargaining phase right after anger is kind of the beginning of rationalizing things. After all that, depression is the next stage of grief. And it's important to realize that depression is a temporary stage because it sure seems like it's forever when you're there. And it seems like a bottomless pit that you can't possibly get out of. But the next phase after the depression, and you need to seek help with the depressive stage. You don't it's like, don't do this at home by yourself.
Yeah.
Depression is serious stuff, and it can take you down if you're not equipped for it, and not everybody is. You may have earlier life experiences that predispose you towards it even. So you don't want to, handle that stage of loss by yourself. You want to pick up a professional, preferably. There's always the good friend slash bartender level assistance that's out there.
Yeah.
But in this kind of a case, having somebody that's going to do something other than tell you a joke to try and get you out of it is probably the right thing to do. Get somebody who knows what they're doing with a psychology and psychiatry. Not all depression needs medication, but there are some that may end up helping, especially if they know what your EEG looks like, obviously, and we've had some discussions about that.
Right.
Acceptance is the next phase. And acceptance is the last phase. Acceptance and hope, basically. There's light after the darkness of the depression that you were in. You accept the loss, and you see that there's actually hope in life, and you kind of come out of the depths of the loss. And the people who think there's seven stages instead of five also add on the stage of basically processing the grief. And that kind of assumes that you might have already latched on to a professional during the depressive phase to end up guiding you through the processing of your grief, because not everybody processes grief in a positive constructive way.
So James,
There
so somebody goes see a clinician, and they're a professional, and then you have the option for drugs, or you can do neurofeedback. If you do neurofeedback for depression, there's no magic number, but more often than not, would it be about 20, between 20 and 40 sessions, you think?
Yeah, somewhere in that range. And it depends upon, what patterns people have in their brain at the time.
Right.
And everybody can come in the door, for a purpose and have two or three other things actually already going on in their brain. So sometimes it takes a little while to unwrap the onion to get down to the middle of it. And that if there's two or three things, it takes a little bit longer. But it doesn't take forever, and it's a learning process. It's not a treatment, it's training. And as such, at the end, you've got a skill set, not an effect. And it's like a take home. You get it, you've got it. And it's not something that's going to fade and disappear like a massage. Oh man, that massage was so great. That really felt wonderful and relaxed. A week later, I got this kink back. I think I'm going to go back in for another treatment. Well, if it's a training, you've learned how to do it yourself. If it's a treatment, you're dependent upon somebody else for it. And meds are a treatment, not a training. You don't end up with a skill set from taking benzodiazepines or whatever the hell else somebody may give you. You've got a treatment, not a training. So, what level do you need to go to? Oh, a high level neurology, psychiatry, counseling, cognitive behavioral therapy, neurofeedback, a psychologist, psychiatrist. Pick your level. There's a lot of different levels of support. If you're going with pharma, obviously you're going to have to go to a psychiatrist for that. Now, some people say go to your GP and save the expense of the specialist. But if you got a stubbed toe, the GP's fine. If you broke your wrist, the GP's probably fine to refer you to the orthopedist. But If you've got severe depression from a loss, a psychiatrist, if you're going to end up going for medication, a psychiatrist at the appropriate level. And not all psychiatrists are going to throw meds at you. A lot of them are oriented towards integrative psychiatry, and they're going to try nutraceuticals and cognitive behavioral and things like that before they go pharma. So pick your psychiatrist carefully as well.
So. And then Jay, HRV was in the news. Unfortunately, Damar Hamlin got a blow to the chest and was, man, that was scary. It was an NFL game. It was a routine tackle. It gets trauma to the chest. And
this is not unheard of in sports, you know, baseball, softball,
hockey.
Hockey, any direct contact sports. You can roll your clock back to grade school and junior high and high school. There's rare, very rare occurrences where somebody gets hit in the chest with a pitch or a hard throw or something, and there's a certain latency between the heart stopping and then you collapsing. It's like a one, a two, a three, a four, but blunk, you're on the ground. So circulatory time, the amount of time that the oxygen that's in the brain can support cognitive function. But you saw that on him. He was hit. He bounced up almost instantly. It looked like, oh, well, just a little bit of nothing. You know, he's back up on his feet. And then you saw a little wobble and then blunk, like he was on a hinge.
Yeah.
Straight back, bam, hit his head. And luckily, it was the heart stoppage, not a bleed. You can end up having a bleed next to the heart. It will do the same thing. It'll put you down just as quick. The difference is the treatment. If you're in a trauma center and they realize there's a bleed, chest compressions are absolutely contraindicated. How the hell would you know that on the field? Only if you had a trauma specialist, you know, right. and the likelihood of that, I mean, they don't even have good head trauma specialists, and they're having apparently trouble finding them now.
Yeah.
So their response, oh, let's lower the standards of who we're looking for. You know, come on. This isn't a business. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
You know, and they're making decisions on dropping the quality of the item that they're looking for, kind of like an Amazon move, as opposed to a proper professional choice.
Jay, we're talking about chemical energy in the heart. The trauma happened at the right moment to screw up the energy, just like when you get hit in the brain. But now I'm going to get ahead of my skis here, but it seems like the reptilian part of the brain seems to kick in if your heart knocks out. What's going on in the brain to pass? I mean, if the blood stops, okay, that's it. Nothing's going on. But what's happening in the brain?
Well, in the brain, you need oxygen and glucose to function, and a little ketones as well, balance out the mix of metabolic support. But when your heart stops and you're no longer pumping blood through, oxygen levels will drop because you're using up the oxygen that's there and it's not being replaced. When oxygen drops, you basically end up having a hypoxia, which creates a glutamate cascade, which creates cell death. Now, cell death doesn't sound very good, and it's not. You know, it's a bad circumstance, but it's the natural progression towards brain death. Now, they got him. Luckily, it wasn't a bleed, and they were doing chest compressions, and they had a defibrillator. Apparently, they defibbed him on the field, and then again in the hospital, his heart stopped again. It was a severe trauma. So hypoxia occurs, glutamate cascade occurs, if you go into a coma, unconscious, in a coma from hypoxia, the amount of time that you have to be in a coma with no response before you're declared basically not probably able to recover is 3 months. In a head trauma, it's a year. Hypoxia is a much more severe loss of consciousness than a trauma. And because of that, the hypoxic circumstance has to be avoided at all costs. We don't know exactly how much time he was without, oxygen and how severe that was. They didn't, there wasn't any trauma specialist out there saying, quick, hit him with barbiturates, put him into a barbiturate coma so his brain doesn't need oxygen. It's a protective coma. And if they were really wise, had a trauma person on the field with all the gear that they needed, a deliberate coma would have been an appropriate move. That's what they did when they got him into the hospital. Now, how much time did it take to the hospital? They were on the field a long time, and they were doing what they could with the trainers and some independent practitioners, but there was no trauma specialist. And they need head trauma specialists, and they just need trauma specialists because you can have an injury that needs a trauma specialist.
You just had a bunch of car crashes on the field there, right?
Well, I think the most violent crash that you can predict on the field is a kickoff return. That's a train in one direction and a train in the other direction. And this isn't one of those algebra questions as to where they meet or something. They're going to meet. You just hope it's not head on, and literally head on. It's inherently a violent game, and there's no way around that. They're trying to moderate it. Newer helmets. If you do a helmet to helmet, you get penalized or thrown out of the game, or the quarterbacks are being protected. I mean, it's almost you can't, if you touch them too hard in some fashion, they've swapped the rules around to try and keep it from being as blatantly damaging. But it's a violent game. There's a lot of violent games. Basketball can be equally violent.
Cheerleading.
Go all the way up and into the air and have somebody clip your feet out from underneath you and land on the back of your neck. See if that doesn't end up doing something for you. Soccer, people run into each other, full force. There's some nasty, violent crashes and a lot of things. Swimming. Well, swimming's so easy. Be a backstroker or come in hard on the wall and see what it does to the back of your head. Almost any kind of a sport can end up having a sports-related injury. Some sports more probable than others. Chess, I don't, it's a game more than a sport, I guess. You're likely maybe carpal tunnel from, I don't
Yeah,
know.
but have you ever watched Bobby Fischer? Just
So,
saying.
heart rate variability is a way to train your heart to have more resilience. Now he was 24 years old. He probably had very healthy heart function, and it's just the luck of the draw to have a severe direct trauma to the heart and shock it to a stop. But there are people that need to learn how to have a more resilient heart. if your heart becomes too stable, if your beat to beat to beat to beat is too stable, it's a rigid system, and it's likely to collapse. It's likely to stop. Heart failure is predicted by too stable a heart rate. Now you think, oh, a nice stable heart rate is not so stable. You know, something sounds good about that. But variability is resilience. Systems have to be flexible, or if they're under pressure, they shatter or collapse. If they're flexible, they'll bend and kind of, you know, find a way around what's causing the pressure. And in systems theory, resilience is variability. And heart rate variability, having a higher amount of variance between your inhale and exhale, ends up having a predictive value. And again, it's a more resilient heart rate. It may not have anything directly to do with the football injury, but you know, in general, if you want to keep your heart resilient and able to recover from things, just right, normal life things, not a necessarily a football helmet that full speed to the chest, but you know, the normal life stressors, HRV is a really, really good option.
Well, I thought it
balances
was
sympathetic and parasympathetic balance.
Yeah, the lack of oxygen to the brain and how that would affect in the coma and all that. And I didn't even think about putting him in a coma on the field. That was NFL's gonna, you know, you want to keep making money.
No, you can't put everybody on the field in a coma and have a game.
You know? So, you know, it's like more lawyers and doctors on the sidelines.
Yeah, and you know, it's a difficult circumstance to end up having to respond in an emergency situation that's not in a hospital emergency room or a trauma center. You know, the doctor on the sidelines can say, we need barbiturates to put him in a coma. And let's see, where is that barbiturate syringe? Oh, in the hospital.
Yeah.
Not on the sidelines, in the hospital. It might be in the ambulance, but well, it's not probably sitting on the sidelines.
You would think they spend hundreds of millions of dollars of these new stadiums where you can put a nightclub in an end zone. You can put a trauma facility in.
You know, and some of them have you know, small scanning devices, not necessarily a full hospital MRI or something, but yeah, they have some medical facility there. But, you know, this will probably have them rethinking whether they need trauma specialist. And again, if they're having trouble finding people to evaluate for head trauma, they're going to have a long stretch looking for trauma specialists.
Fair enough. So, Jay, what's next on the alphabet?
Ah, well, you know, we went through fasciculi and Fs and all of that, frontal and all of that last time. We're all the way up to the G's. And, you know, gee whiz, what's a G in the brain? Oh, maybe like the geniculate, lateral geniculate for vision. You know, that's the thalamic relay of all your vision back to the back of your head. It vision hits you in the eye, goes down the optic nerve to the optic chiasm. It's split between to the other hemisphere, upper and lower visual fields. I mean, all of that ends up being relayed through the lateral geniculate, way to the back of your head. And that's not where you necessarily see, but it's where you kind of start to see. The visual input to the back of your head is really kind of like the static on an old television where the rasters didn't line up to make an image. It's just raw data. It's too raw to actually be perceived. In the back of your head, in the occipital area, it's convex, concave, this angle, that angle, the other angle, dark surrounded by light, light surrounded by dark. I mean, it's all be rubricized raw perceptual pieces that aren't integrated. And it takes about three levels of integration, sometimes more, to get up into the parietal area so that the angles and the dots and the dashes and everything line up to make some kind of an image, but it's still not fully comprehended. It's just integrated into an image. You know, the vertical line and the convex concave line might make the letter D, and then you got an O and a G. But in the parietal area, you don't know if that's dog or God. You know, it could be either. It's not integrated into a comprehension. That happens in the highest level of integration in the temporal lobe areas. Wernicke's area on the left. And I make a bad joke that nobody laughs at, and it's appropriate not to laugh at it. On the right-hand side, if Wernicke had a sister, we'd have his damn name on both sides. You know, she would have studied emotion instead of language. But it's just a bad joke. There's only one Wernicke on the left. The equivalent on the right is for emotion, facial expressions and body language, and the sound of speech, the song of speech. My, what a good dog you are today. Or my, what a bad dog you are today. The dog responds to the lilt of the voice, not to the words good dog and bad dog. Now, if you say bad dog or good dog, you know, it's a song that they hear, not the words. So, you know, the prosodic perception on the right hemisphere ends up being integrated. And so eventually your brain integrates both the song and the words of speech to know whether there's sarcasm or irony, some of the subtle forms of humor. If, assuming you assume you think it's humorous, you know, I mean, somebody saying something sarcastic to you, you may not think it's so damn funny. But even to perceive that requires the understanding of the song of speech. And in the Asperger's autism, for instance, where they have difficulty with the subtleties of humor, get a severe autistic Asperger's person to tell a joke sometime. You know, it's very concrete. It's not, there's no irony, sarcasm kind of stuff in it. That's lost on them at that point. A lot of training later, they get it. You know, neurofeedback is astounding on the ability to actually get these brain areas working in autism with language problems and autism with social perceptual problems. So we've got the lateral geniculate for vision. Auditory stuff goes to the geniculate, the medial geniculate. And it's a direct relay of the cochlea. If you took the cochlea, the kind of snail shell structure in your ear, it's got little tiny hair cells inside of it that vibrate at different frequencies. The big fat end of the is a low frequency, and the little tiny end is the higher frequencies. And that's basically projected into your temporal parietal junction, where the temporal lobe kind of tucks up next to the side of the brain. On the inside of the back edge of that temporal lobe, you have your auditory cortex, high frequency, low frequency. It's a point-by-point representation of the cochlea. And so you get relay of sound directly from your sensory end organ, in this case, not your eyes, but your ears, and it goes through the medial geniculate, and it's relayed directly back to your auditory cortex. The trick is in EEG that the auditory cortex is tucked into that fold. It's not pointed out. It's hard to see in the temporal area activity coming from the auditory cortex. The auditory cortex is angled because it's folded in, it's angled up. And brainstem auditory evoked responses, BAER, bear testing, is done for infants that are deaf, for instance. You can't ask an infant, can you hear me? And they will say yes, they can't speak yet. You can clap your hands next to them and see if they respond, but you know, that's awfully crude. How about if you put a headset on him and send in a series of clicks, and their brain is going to respond to those clicks if they can hear them. And where do they see that response? Dead center on the top of your head, because both auditory cortices are angled up towards the top of your head and not out towards the temporal area.
Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide Workshop March 4th and 5th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops.
So that enfolding into the temporoparietal junction kind of insulates them from a simple surface a spot. The P100, the 100 millisecond arrival of sound at the cortex, happens at CZ, not next to the, you know, auditory cortex right next to it. It's where the parietal cell is oriented. So, you know, we've got G covered for geniculates. But, you know, it's not the only G. G, there's more Gs. Globus pallidus. The globus pallidus is obviously an important structure with respect to motor function. It's part of the frontal striatal thalamocortical inhibition of movement, but it's also the spot that can flip that inhibition into perseveration. If your cingulate becomes involved with the globus pallidus, it adds one more little step to the loop. The normal loop for inhibition is frontal cortex to the caudate, to the putamen, to the globus pallidus, to the thalamus, and then the motor strip. That has a net excess of one GABA, so it's inhibitory. The frontal lobe can inhibit motor function. If the cingulate becomes involved with the globus pallidus, it adds a little extra step. Instead of going cortex to the caudate, putamen, globus pallidus, thalamus, goes globus pallidus, subthalamus, thalamus, adding another GABA into the loop. So the frontal lobe's inhibitory becomes a perseverative command. The frontal lobe says stop. The effect at the other end, once the cingulate's involved, is stop stopping. And that's perseverative. So obsessive compulsive disorder, normal choice flexibility as to respond, not respond. All of that has to do with this network and the globus pallidus deep in the forebrain ends up being involved in that. So it's a kind of a critical crossroads for free will, voluntary choice of go, no go. And it obviously a major piece of the circuitry that's off in motor dysregulation, hyperactivity, and that sort of thing. So there's probably other G's in there, you know.
Those are the big ones.
I'm
old. Don't mess with gamma.
Oh yeah. We could do gamma. Gamma is obviously not a structure. It's a brain frequency range. There's gamma one, approximately 40 hertz, and gamma two, 80 to 100 hertz. And Gert Furtscheller, who's retired, but he's a major figure in neuroscience in Graz, Austria. His laboratory at the Technical University in Graz, he came up with event-related synchronization, desynchronization, and wavelet analysis was really more fully developed in his laboratory, looking at the rhythmicity at high frequencies. It's hard to see those little buggers. You know, 1 over F, the faster you are, the smaller you are. So if you're up at 100 hertz or so, you know, it isn't like you're going to get this gigantic waveform, but you're going to see rhythmicity. So you can look with wavelet analysis or Hilbert transforms to see the rhythmicity. It doesn't have to be big. It just has to be rhythmic. And gamma is not state. It's content. Alpha and theta, that's state. And the gamma will be nested in the theta or alpha. And that's content. The content is different than state. The state of a Zen master and a yoga master may be the same state, but they have different content. And that's easily demonstrated. If you have a yoga master whose philosophy has taught them that the outside world is false, it's Maya, a false world out there. If you present a repetitive stimulus in the environment of a yoga master, they habituate to it almost instantly. It's false. Why respond? A yoga master. So a Zen master whose philosophy is different, they're in the same state. It's not like North Dakota. This is like a state, you know, internal state. So they're in the same state. But the Zen master has learned that the beginner's mind is the master's mind. And every perception is a new perception. Everything is the new. The second time you see it is still new. The fifth time you see it, it's still new. So why would you habituate to repetitive stimulus if every one of them is new? A normal person lies somewhere in between the Zen and the yoga master on their rate of habituation. But you can differentiate a yoga master from a Zen master, not by their state, but by their content. And that content, again, is not the lower frequencies, it's the higher frequencies that contain the content that you've learned associated with the state. Now, obviously, a Zen master that's learned, their internal state, that can be identified, and gamma has been identified as an extreme amount of gamma in the Dalai Lama's monks in Richard Davidson's lab in Wisconsin. And kind of love of the outside world and acceptance and all of that end up corresponding with that. But it also changes their immune reactions the interaction between your state and your immune reaction ends up being something that medicine would love to harness. You know, oh, that's like your placebo response. Yeah. If you could put a saddle on that horse, you'd win the damn race. So that they would love to be able to harness the effect that all of this, you know, 20 years of meditation training has acquired. There are those that think that neurofeedback can speed up the acquisition. I have to say, you can get the state, but the content has to go along with it. I would hypothesize that you could have the same state with a mass murderer. You know, it's the state, it's not the content. Mm-hmm. You can be in that state and have all sorts of other things going on. So it's probably not as common, you know, but luckily mass murderers aren't that common. State isn't the same thing as being a Zen master. There are people that will charge you thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to become a Zen master brain state. Doesn't mean you're a Zen master. It means you've got the state. What you fill that state with, the philosophy you fill the state with is content. And that has to match up in order for you to end up considering yourself anywhere close to being a Zen master or a yoga master. Or maybe a mass murderer. So.
Jay, you allowed me to stray away from anatomy to the frequency with gamma. Maybe you'll allow me to stray on this tangent. Gabapentin and nerve pain. Is it possible to do neurofeedback and get relief, the same type of relief from nerve pain than gabapentin?
Gabapentin strips away excitatory neurotransmitters, and it does kind of take the edge off of pain. It doesn't eliminate the sensation entirely. And it's used mostly, it's an anticonvulsant, and it's used mostly for nerve pain. Diabetic nerve pain is probably one of the most common, where you've actually lost the neurons because of your diabetic problems, and your feet tingle or burn or feel like needles and pins. Now, the pokey little needly feelings are going to be kind of dampened. The excitatory neurochemistry kind of cuts down on some of this peripheral nerve pain. It cuts down also on what's called central pain, where there isn't something causing the pain. The pain is actually generated centrally in the brain. Cancer patients, there are significant pathologies that can give you central pain. And gabapentin, sometimes its more potent, bigger cousin, Lyrica, a pregabalin instead of gabapentin, which is Neurontin. So, but anticonvulsants can be used for pain. And those two anticonvulsants are both cut down on excitatory neurochemistry. Now, you can dampen down the brain's response to pain with neurofeedback as well. It's not quick. I mean, there's a learning curve associated with it. And if you've got somebody who's in acute distress, you know, the pharma approach is now, the neurofeedback approach is a few months from now, maybe we should work together. You know, like some of the work on ADD that was done with meds and neurofeedback. Vince Monastra, one of the early pioneers in alpha, in theta beta, and working with methylphenidate for theta. They went into a school. They gave all the kids in the school that were hyperactive, that had a high theta-beta ratio, they gave them theta-beta ratio style training for half of the students and meds for all the students. Everybody in the study got meds. And they, you know, meds, the right med for that, they got better. Half of them got neurofeedback as well. 6 months later, they pulled the meds. Neurofeedback people stayed okay. The ones who were meds only reverted back to their hyperactive ways. So, you know, working not in opposition to pharma, but in cooperation with pharma, in many cases, ends up being, you know, strongly indicated. If I see epileptiform bursts in an EEG, I always suggest a combination of anticonvulsants and neurofeedback. The sooner you quiet down the network and it's not firing together, it won't wire together. And if you don't use it, you lose it. Slowly, the network will unwrap. And if you break up that network, you don't have the seizures anymore. So the successful work we've done with intractable epilepsy has been in combination with meds, but eventually the meds are withdrawn as well.
Do they taper off the meds?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You can't just, if you're on, quite a few meds, if you just pull them, you end up with a rebound. And rebound hyperexcitability, if you pull an anticonvulsant, is expected. And it's not a good thing. So quickly stopping. I've been told that the Valium I've been on for the last 10 years is a bad thing. and I have to agree it's a bad thing. So I go, stop it all of a sudden. Well, that's a bad thing.
That's not good.
The rebound hyperexcitability may give you your first ever seizure as a withdrawal seizure from a sedating medication. So H, the next letter up.
Oh, can only imagine, Jay.
What the H, you know?
What the H?
habenula. So what the hell's a habenula? Where did I have left it? It's around here somewhere, you know. Sometimes it's called the epithalamus. And it was actually the name habenular nucleus derived from haben, which was the stalk at the base of the pineal gland. And that name kind of evolved into some of the local nuclear bodies, which include the habenula. So the habenula nucleus isn't just one. You know, what I like about hanging out with Dirk De Ridder, the neurosurgeon, MD, PhD, academic neurosurgeon, is that about the time you think you know a piece in the brain, oh, the habenula, there it is. He'll say, oh, well, there's the lateral habenula and the medial habenula. And they're different, and they do different things, you know. So, damn, you know, I gotta get more complex, you know. And then you find out, well, the lateral habenula has like actually five little subnuclear bodies, and the medial has maybe 10 little subnuclear bodies. So, you know, the finer gradation of knowledge you get, the finer gradation of knowledge you need. And there's somebody who's one step higher on the hierarchy of knowing things on this impossible learning curve than you are. And you need to learn from them all these one more level of depth of complication here. The lateral habenula basically ends up having control over neurotransmitters. It modulates serotonin, norepinephrine, and also NMDA. And the medial geniculate modulates acetylcholine. So all of these are, you know, vital, important structures. You can't just, you know, pass by them and ignore them. You've got to end up gaining more knowledge about them. Every vertebrate has a habenula. If you're a non-vertebrate, good luck. You don't have one, you know. But if you're a vertebrate, you've got one. Epithalamus, or the habenula, ends up being involved in motivation, addiction, which is involved with motivation, pain, and sometimes pain ends up leading to addiction, and wake-sleep. It modulates wake and sleep. As you might well imagine, if it modulates norepinephrine the serotonin. It also is extremely involvement in depression. It has to do with its NMDA. The habenula has a commissure, the habenula commissure. You have a habenula on the left, you have a habenula on the right, like your epithalamus left and epithalamus right. It's not just a single structure in the center. And the habenula has been noticed to be smaller in those who have depression. So, you know, it's an important structure. It's not high on the list. In severe tinnitus, the habenula ends up being involved in the network of severe tinnitus. About the time that you're so deaf that you don't really hear well enough, your brain will search for memory of sound. And at that point, the habenula is part of that nuclear network. and an example of the sounds that you remember suddenly being sounds that you think you're hearing. Tintinnabulatory tinnitus, one of my favorite onomatopoeia. Tintinnabulatory tinnitus, you know.
Easy for you to say.
And it's hearing bells. As you start to lose your hearing and you get a ringing in the ears, that ringing in the ears is just a high pitch or multiple high pitches. And eventually, if you start to hear the ding, 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 like somebody standing outside for the Salvation Army at Christmas time, the bell ringer, that's tinnitus. But if it gets worse, you can literally hear bell choirs. It's entertaining as hell. You know, I mean, you've heard bell choirs at Christmas, yeah, in some church somewhere, you know, the whole bunch of little kids all standing there with their bells, you know, ding 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 ding, you know, they're playing nice songs. And so instead of hearing the ding ding ding, you actually hear a more complicated ding ding ding. Shortly thereafter, you're going to be hearing things like voices and stuff that aren't necessarily things that are just random dings. So as you start to lose your hearing and the outside world isn't giving you your input, you're going to find inputs from inside. And those are usually considered essentially hallucinatory. But it's a natural attempt to the destruction of the actual ability to hear, the network involved in hearing reaches to memory. And memory ends up giving you illusions of hearing. Now, I lost my hearing a long time ago to rock and roll music, power tools, flying airplanes with my dad as a kid with no hearing protection, you know, too many loud things. And so I went into the audiologist and she tests my ear hearing and she comes back in with this chart that, you know, it's a clunk, you know, your audiogram says that you're deaf. I said, what? I didn't hear her at all.
What?
You know, so, what? You're deaf. What? You know, so she fits me with these hearing aids and now I can hear the alarm on the microwave. The refrigerator door has an alarm if it's been left open. Renita would yell at me from the far end of the house, the refrigerator door is open. And I said, how can you tell? Oh, the alarm's going off. I walk right next to the refrigerator. There's no sound at all coming from the refrigerator that I can detect without my hearing aids in. Put the hearing aids in, ding, 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 there it is, you know. So, you know, as soon as you start to hear the bell choir, it's time to get off your high horse and actually get hearing aids, as opposed to going totally deaf and hearing voices and, you know, having, you know, if you respond to the voices you hear, then people think you're really crazy, you know. So, you know, the habenula ends up being involved in the tinnitus networking at the time when you've lost so much hearing that you tap into memories as part of the ability to, quote, hear. Oh, one more thing.
Okay.
H.
Okay.
Hippocampus. Of course. What was I thinking not to think of the hippocampus? It's
the
your memory processor. It's your memory processor. Why couldn't I remember it? Well, it's the freaking memory processor. That's why I didn't remember it. The hippocampus. It's a really common source of epilepsy. The hippocampus from both injury and vascular issues, ends up being prone to damage. It's a high utilizer of metabolic function. It's busy metabolically compared to a lot of other locations. And mid-temporal sharp slow transients in the EEG in the temporal area quite often are coming from the hippocampus. There's a very nice paper from Niedermeyer who looked at 209 subjects who had mid-temporal sharp slow transients, and they drilled down to try and find out what was really going on, and they found hippocampal problems. You can have vertebrobasilar artery insufficiency, which gives you posterior communicating artery insufficiency, which is the blood supply to the hippocampus. So in older age, as vascular change happens and you don't get your carotid clogged up, if you clog up your vertebral basilar artery, you can end up negatively impacting the hippocampus, which is your memory. Gee, what goes bad when you're old? Geez, I can't remember. I'm old, you know? So the hippocampus.
Is that like the memory chip of the brain? Is it the solid state drive of the brain?
You know, it's hard to make a computer analogy, but it's kind of like the memory bank for the RAM. Brain. It compares everything that's going on with everything that's remembered as well. The anterior cingulate holds a model of everything in it, and the anterior cingulate and hippocampus and amygdala are the major nuclear structures that are in the temporal area, and the anterior cingulate and nucleus accumbens end up forming the anterior aspect of it. All that's responsible for memory, and you compare memory of what you think should be going on with what you perceive is going on, and it tells you whether you're doing it right or not. If you have OCD, the anterior cingulate's usually giving you false messages. You know, you. But the
what
hippocampus.
Happens if you've had a few too many with the hippocampus?
Well, as you slow things down. First of all, as you start to relax a little bit, memories come up. You know, this is old Lang Syne time, you know. We can
Remember
all stand
back
around.
At the yacht club, Jay.
vaguely, yeah. So, hippocampus, it is a memory processor. It's Siamese twin, which is, conjoined twin is a more proper term nowadays. I'm old. My apologies for being such a dinosaur. But conjoined twins, the amygdala and hippocampus are hooked at the hip. If you kick one, the other says, ouch. Memory and emotion. In fact, early on, they would stimulate one and get a response out of the other. And they were saying, oh, the hippocampus is an emotional processor. Oh, the amygdala is a memory processor. And it took quite a bit of time for them to kind of tease out the fact that they were getting responses out of the conjoined twin, not the one they were stimulating, but the one next to it. So over time, with enough quality research, you end up not just lesioning or zapping something, but actually looking at them in natural function, as opposed to, you know, kick it and see who says ouch. They've identified that the amygdala is a primary emotional processor, hippocampus is primary memory processor. If you have one hippocampus removed, you still have memory. If you lose both hippocampi, good luck. Your memory function is kaput. Retrieving memories requires the hippocampi, one at least. It doesn't mean that memory is stored there. They looked forever for the engram. Where is that damn memory stored? If we snip this out, does it take the memory away? Or snip this out, does it? And they were lesioning and they're stimulating. They were looking for where memory was. Memory's not stored anywhere, it's stored everywhere. Holographic, actually holonomic is the proper term. And this is the contribution from Carl Pribram. And Carl was a neurosurgeon, quit doing neurosurgery in 1949. He was one of the first class of people board certified in neurosurgery. He was a great neurosurgeon. But he went into research on consciousness, the hard problem, as they say. And he worked with animals and humans, and some may recognize him as having lost a finger. Rhesus monkey bit him, and he got gangrene and lost his finger. But it was a mother monkey, and he reached there was a baby with her. She was just being protective, and he wasn't angry at her for biting him or him losing his finger. He recognized it was his mistake. You don't, you know, stick your finger in coochie cooing a baby monkey when the mother's there, you know. So yeah. Well, you know, you've seen the same thing with some dogs, you know, the protect the puppies to a point where the mother, who is always a friendly dog, gives you a little nip when you reach for the little pup. So, you know, it happened.
Yeah. Don't mess around with the kids.
Unfortunately, Carl passed, but engrams are not stored anywhere. They're stored everywhere. If you slowly take pieces out of the brain, not rapidly destroy the brain, but slowly eat some away, the memories are still there with a lower and lower and lower resolution. Kind of like breaking the holographic plate. The interference pattern is printed in a plate. If you break it in half, you don't have half of the image in here and half of the image here. You've got the entire image with half the resolution on both pieces. Break them into pieces. Every piece, smaller and smaller and smaller, has the entire image on it, just with a lower resolution. So, memories are stored in a distributed manner across the brain, not in a specific location. But to retrieve them requires certain circuitry, and the hippocampus is crucial for that circuitry. One will do, two is better.
Zero is not good.
Zero won't work at all.
You're offline.
At least not that I remember.
Jay Gunkelman, thank you so much. Letters G and H, what a great show.
The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience's NeuroGuide Workshop March 4th and 5th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now.